I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the day before St. Patrick's Day, which is Thanksgiving for me. March 16th, all things political coming up this hour, which you always hear Mondays at 1 o'clock. Our guest this hour is Lauren Victoria Burke. She's a political analyst who created Crew of 42. It's a blog that covers African-American members of Congress. She writes for Politic 365, a digital destination for politics related to communities of color. We'll be looking at Hillary Clinton's hidden email. Every time you turn around, our guest writes, there's some sort of problem coming out of Clintonlandia, and anything that reminds us of the bad old soap opera days of the 1990s is a problem moving forward. What does the Democratic Party need to do to stop losing elections? It centers on state legislatures. Lauren has written about that. Why didn't Eric Holder disband the Ferguson Police Department? Why are singing racist chants and racially tinged parties occurring on such a widespread level on campus fraternities and some sororities? Will there be a vote this week on Loretta Lynch for Attorney General? The president meets with the leadership of the Council of Great City Schools to talk about educational opportunities in cities. And politicians take swipes at each other at the annual Gridiron Club dinner, which took place over the weekend. Do you think Washington might have a different feel to it if there were gridiron dinners every month? Everybody was funny. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Lauren. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Lauren has covered politics on Capitol Hill since 1998, began her career assisting Cokie Roberts at ABC News. She was a staffer on Capitol Hill. She's worked for USAtoday.com, The Washington Post, The Hill, and the Associated Press, and is the author of two books, including Birth of a Statesman, which is a book of photography documenting President Obama's 2008 campaign for the White House. She also covered several political campaigns, including Hillary Clinton's 2000 run for the Senate and President Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. And so that's what's happening this hour. Hi, Lauren. Thanks very much for being with us.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. Let's start. I didn't think we would start there, but I started reading some of the jokes from the Gridiron Dinner, and it got me thinking, yeah, they really ought to have these more often, and maybe everybody would get along a little better, you think?
Yeah, how about that? And what comes with that is that there's a rule at the Gridiron that you're not supposed to tweet or report certain little skits that go on during the dinner, which are very humorous. So I've heard. I was not at the dinner on Saturday night, but that alone, just the fact that, people can trust each other at least for a few hours is a good thing. And, of course, the camaraderie and the connection that happens during the dinner, it probably is sort of the last bastion of open candor that we have in Washington, D.C.
Right. Why do you think Governor Scott Walker, it seems to me to be a pretty big thing to be the Republican representative on the stage with the president and with Terry McAuliffe giving the Democratic jokes for the evening. Do you have any idea why he was chosen for that?
You know, other than his poll ratings, which, you know, right now he is the flavor of the month, you know, that's a really good question. But, of course, effectively, when it comes to the politicians who attend, almost anyone can sort of be there on the stage or be on the day. It's sort of like a correspondence dinner, where if you're invited by somebody or if you're invited to sit at the table of a news organization, you can be there. So, you know, everything maybe in this case, we may be looking a little bit too much into it as a strategic political move, but then again, that is understandable because this is D.C., but I don't have any inside knowledge as to why he was there.
Yeah, you know, it did give him a lot of attention because certainly the president had some jabs at Scott Walker, too.
Exactly right. And, you know, I'm sure the folks at the White House, once they found out that he was going to be president, they probably rewrote a few of the jokes. But, you know, because the dinner is seen as a place, an island of, okay, let's joke and let's be candid and let's just be light and that's it. Kind of like the Al Smith dinner in New York every year, people sort of let go of things, I think, a little quicker. We've seen some pretty biting humor, not so much at the Gridiron Club dinner, although we have seen it there, but at the correspondence dinner in particular, And it's so funny. I feel like over the years I've seen people let it go a little quicker than they might if it was an actual, you know, real serious debate someplace in the halls of Congress.
Let's talk about Hillary Clinton's emails, and let me just say the jokes. There isn't any audio of this, but the president on Hillary Clinton's emails, think about how things have changed since 2008. Back then, I was the young tech-savvy candidate of the future. Now I'm yesterday's news, and Hillary has got a server in her house and Walker on Hillary Clinton. I even have Hillary's private email. No, not that one. Not the other one either. I have the special one that even Terry McAuliffe doesn't have. It goes right to her campaign headquarters. You know, it's HillaryClinton@WallStreet.com. The best part about that joke is Elizabeth Warren wrote it for me, which is pretty funny, but I bet everybody's got Wall Street on their speed dial in Washington, right?
Yeah, that is a really funny joke. You know what? The Hillary Clinton, if you knew that there was one joke that would happen during the evening, that would be one of the themes. But inside the party, there's not a whole lot of joking on the Democratic side because people are, I think, a little bit worried. I'll be finding out a little bit more about that, you know, this week as we talk to some of the members on the Democratic side. But, you know, it's not the first thing that has come up with Hillary Clinton, so people have gotten, people are a little bit worried about it, actually.
Right. I can see how they would be. And you wrote in your recent piece, every time you turn around, there's some sort of problem coming out of Clintonlandia. It's probably true if it were George Bush or Condi Rice or Dick Cheney, you write, with their own private survey and email server and email at home, absolutely no one on the Democratic side would stay silent. No, they wouldn't.
Exactly right. And, you know, the problem with it is when you have sort of bumps in the road on a book tour, I mean, that should be a fairly easy thing. In a way, this is kind of along the same lines because in Washington, it's very familiar to everybody that all federal employees, for the most part, have two phones, particularly if you work on Capitol Hill at the White House. And as somebody who's met with a lot of people who work in government and who had worked in government myself, you have to have two separate phones. You can't do personal work on your work phone and vice versa. So it's not uncommon to see a federal employee with two phones. So the fact that she wasn't doing that is very surprising to a lot of people.
I think the other thing that's surprising, and I don't know what this says, but don't you find it unusual that maybe things will change, but chances are fairly good that we're going to have another Clinton and another Bush at the top of the presidential ticket for 2016?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is something that I think we'll sort of, you know, we'll see how the other candidates do. I actually think that there's a chance, certainly on the Republican side, that it won't be Jeb Bush. A much greater chance it won't be Jeb Bush than it is that it won't be Hillary Clinton, because it certainly looks like it's likely to be Hillary Clinton as we sit here today. But I think for a lot of people, they may have been too young to remember every detail of the Clinton presidency, not so much, of course, with Bush, or at least Bush, George W. Bush. So it's not as big of a leap for people to make. But at the same time, you know, I think that at some point in this, you know, I do think voters are going to have a little bit of trouble getting around the corner of, okay, these are the same people with the same ideas. And I do think that that is going to affect the older half of the electorate. Because anybody over 45 or so years old will be able to obviously remember George W. Bush and some of the Clinton presidency. So we'll see how they deal with it. In the case of Hillary Clinton, she's got these some foundation issues to answer for now, because the Clinton Foundation has collected so much, raised so much money. And of course, on the Bush side, even though he didn't do it, we're going to be thinking and talking about the Iraq war again. So these are things that clearly will be issues during the campaign.
Yeah. So why is it likely that it's going to be Hillary Clinton? Why is she the one who will be nominated? And it was sort of a foregone conclusion some years ago. Why?
Well, one of the things is she, of course, has the apparatus for fundraising down better than anybody, primarily, I think, because of her husband. So people see it as, okay, who can raise enough money to do this? And obviously, every cycle, it just gets higher and higher and higher. So I think people think of her immediately as the likely candidate for that reason alone. I mean, Bill Clinton is still a big star at political events, and a lot of times when I go to things, he is, if his name is on there, the room is full. So people think, to some extent, that may translate over to her. I actually don't think that it will. I don't think she's anywhere near as good a campaigner as he is. So, and I think that that is definitely going to be an issue for her. But so there's sort of an heir apparent feeling.
Right.
But No, that may not stop Joe Biden or somebody else from running.
Yeah. Well, you covered her for the Senate in the year 2000. Has she made great gains as a campaigner, would you say, or not?
I would probably say that she hasn't. I covered a little bit of her in 2007 and 8 and really just stopped because I, you know, as a freelance reporter, and at the time I was a freelance reporter, I just stopped working for, I think I was working full-time for The Hill at the time, and then I stopped doing that and did freelance full-time. And, you know, one of the things that I find is that you cover, when you're a freelancer, you try to cover who's easier to cover from a logistical standpoint and sometimes even from a personal standpoint. And Hillary Clinton was extremely difficult to cover. You know, always late for events. Her press people were not very accommodating. Now, a lot of people who are the front runners in these races tend to be that way, so it wasn't that shocking. But quite frankly, the person who would eventually win, Barack Obama, he and his staff were a lot easier to deal with, and he was on time. You know, so these things start to matter a lot when you're in, you know, when you're someplace in South Carolina or New Hampshire, Iowa, you start getting annoyed at people doing certain things like being late for 3 hours and there's no explanation for it. And that was one of the problems. The Clinton campaign was very disorganized in 2007 and 8, and that was part of the reason she lost. What I remember from the Senate race in 2000 was that it was a very quiet race. She was running against Rick Lazio, and it was an easy race. Karen Finney, who is now known basically from being on CNN and MSNBC, was her press secretary. And it was just a nice and easy race. We were basically just riding through Dutchess County, New York, and a nice, easy event. There wasn't a whole lot of tension on that race in the Senate.
Let's move to, you wrote a very interesting piece, and it's good for Democrats to remember this, I think. You looked at the Pew study, the Democratic losses connected to state losses and to redistricting. Let me reiterate the numbers that you cite. Democrats have lost 69 House seats, 13 Senate seats, 910 state legislative seats, 30 state legislative chambers, 11 governorships, all since 2008. They must be doing some soul-searching, are they?
Well, I hope they are. The only person on the Democratic side who really acknowledged after the 2014 election and the lowest turnout in 72 years that, okay, there's a problem, we really need to sit and analyze it, was Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And ironically, the rumor is that President Obama wanted to fire Debbie Wasserman Schultz, which makes no sense to me, because if there was anybody involved in the situation who should not have been fired, it was her. You have Steve Israel, who was the chair, who at the time was the chair of the DCCC. You have Nancy Pelosi involved. You have Harry Reid involved. I don't know why Debbie Wasserman Schultz would be the person to blame. They need a real cleaning of house, it would seem to me, at DCCC, and they need to really explain themselves on spending millions and millions of dollars on get-out-the-vote efforts that clearly didn't work. You don't get the lowest turnout in 72 years by accident. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party, other than Debbie Wasserman Schultz, they just did a self-study. The DNC did a pretty nice self-study in which it was revealed what Howard Dean told them 6 years ago, which is that you have to work on the state houses, local races, and put money into redistricting. So there was nothing found out that they didn't know already, but for some reason there are certain people who are making the decisions in the Democratic Party who apparently don't know that.
Mm-hmm. And what about on the Republican side? I can remember doing talk shows not that long ago where we were discussing how the Republicans needed to fashion a message to reach more Hispanic voters. They don't seem to have done very well on that front, have they?
They have not done well at all, and of course the numbers for them keep dropping over and over again. Every 4 years, the number for the Latino vote gets, you know, smaller and smaller. But what they have done very well at is the redistricting and the drawing of maps and the local state races and having the understanding that that is what will control congressional seats and the maps for congressional seats. So they've done really well spending on that, concentrating on that. As we understand, the population of the United States is becoming browner and blacker as we go on here. And for some reason, the Republican Party has not understood that. But Ed Gillespie, when he was in charge of the statewide races, I think this is back in 2007 and 8, he put millions of dollars in that, and it really created a result for them in 2010 when the Republicans took over the House of Representatives.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Lauren. Victoria Burke, our guest this hour, obviously knows her politics, as you can tell from the first 20 minutes of conversation. This is All Things Political, and she has been covering politics on Capitol Hill since 1998. She's a writer and a political analyst. She created Crew of 42, a blog that covers African-American members of Congress, and she is currently doing a great deal of writing for Politic 365. Here's our phone number. We've started with the Hillary Clinton emails, a story that is not going away. We've looked at the Democrats not taking a deep enough, perhaps long enough, analysis of why they've been losing so many races since 2008. Is it inevitable that it's going to be Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush? Does that excite you? Do you think that people will turn out the polls and feel passionate about one candidate or another? We have other issues that we'll be talking about as well. There are a lot of issues of race in the news lately. One question, the only question actually, that Lauren says that should have been asked of Eric Holder was, why didn't you disband the Ferguson Police Department? If they're so bad, why not disband them? We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the president's really uplifting speech at Selma. I'm sure that Lauren will have some things to say about that speech, which is one for the ages, I think. I want to spend a little bit of time on this fraternity issue. It's hard for me to believe it's 2015 and people are singing these kinds of horrible racist chants. And it turns out that there are allegations of racism and racist chants and actions at universities all over the country, where the majority white fraternities and sororities, not that a majority of them are engaged in this, but there are too many to be comfortable with, we shouldn't be comfortable with any. So why is that? What should be done about that? And the email story that we started with that, do you think that it is a big deal? Here's our phone number, and we have lines open for you at this very moment for All Things Political. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Everybody wants, on the progressive side, everyone wants her to run.
Right.
And it's funny, in trying to talk to her, as a reporter on Capitol Hill or any journalist on Capitol Hill trying to talk to her, near impossible. She generally never talks to the press. She
really?
Will do an occasional, yeah, and it's really annoying because everyone wants to talk to her. And even something innocuous is difficult. She does do press conferences, and so you do have an opportunity when she does a press conference on something, and often it is a very progressive issue. There is a chance then, but generally speaking, like in the hallway, you have a great opportunity during votes to just walk up to a senator and talk to them, and she's not one of the ones that's a big talker. So, it's hard to tell what she's going to do, not to say that if you did talk to her, she's going to say, yeah, I'm going to run for president, but I'm just saying it's hard to feel her out on anything. But, of course, she is the person that everybody, I talk to so many people that want her to run, and I think it's a very good reason, because when somebody stands on principle like that on a consistent basis, it gets the type of energy and fervor that people really want to, that people really come out to vote for. And she's certainly not a canned, predictable politician. She believes in something, and people really feel strongly about that.
Why doesn't she talk to the press, Lauren?
I don't know what it is. You know, people sometimes, I think, receive bad advice. And what I found in covering politicians is that people who come out of the private sector, whether it's professor or business leader or whatever, and then they come into Congress as their first job in government, they're often terrible with the press because they just don't get it. They have sort of a corporate view of the press. People who come out of the state house, maybe they were a city council member or even just a school board member or somebody who was a state senator, they come into Congress and they view the press as part of their job. They don't view it as somebody, as something to be scared of, and they're the ones that are usually very, very easy to deal with. So, that it follows suit that Elizabeth Warren, who has not been a elected official for very long, it follows suit that she doesn't talk to the press.
Let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Jim in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk today about winning a core element of the vote that I think will make the difference, and that's the white male over 40. And I was talking to a neighbor recently, and this fellow is originally Polish Catholic, but he left the Catholic Church because he became disenchanted when a single priest who was counseling on marriage, doing marriage counseling, which is required in the Catholic Church before marriage, turned out to be a pedophile. And so he's in a Protestant faith now. But it got him thinking, because he just thought, well, geez, all these things that they've said in the past, maybe they just made it up as they went along. And so the idea that you can't be married or the social issues, things of that nature. He doesn't care about the social issues, basically. Well, what he wants is a government that's honest, where people enforce the law and do what they say they're going to do, instead of just going through the motions and giving up when it actually comes down to the real deal on regulation. And so he's interested in just being economic issues, being able to take care of his family, keep his family together, keep his family healthy. Because if you lose your job or if you lose your health, your whole world falls apart under you. So a lot of the issue, quote, social issues are come across as being presented in shrill tones, and instead just talking about being able to maintain the family, I think, is a key issue to a guy like this.
All right, Jim, I need to hold you there. We have a lot of callers. Is that the issue now? Do people not care as much about social issues? Lauren,
well,
what do you think?
I actually think that people, I think the caller has a point in terms of the Democratic Party has spent a lot of time sort of focusing on niche groups, quite frankly. We see that in the immigration debate. We see that certainly the gay lobby has gotten a lot of things that it's wanted for years. Nothing terribly wrong with that. But at the same time, I think anyone, whether it's a white male over 40 or anybody else, we're all interested in education, jobs, money, taxes, those types of issues. And you can see the Democratic Party, to some extent, has sort of floated away from that. And the Republicans are sort of trying to, I think, to some extent, exploit that opening. I don't know that that's really working for them very well, but I think that is their attempt.
Thanks, Jim, very much for your call. Let's go to Joel in Appleton. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to piggyback on, I guess, exactly what your guest was talking about a moment ago. I think part of the reason why the Democrats, or a big part of why they did so bad in the past midterm election, was that they weren't really running on their successes. They're still kind of afraid to be Democrats, you know, or trying to seem like they're more conservative than maybe what they should. To me, the big issue is socioeconomic, and they were running on women's issues in Colorado and different elections, different areas of the country, gender politics, and I just don't think that resonated with the base. I think I think the reason why Elizabeth Warren is so popular is because she seems like one of the few Democrats that's willing to address the wealth gap, which is really becoming an opportunity gap.
Lauren.
Right. Elizabeth Warren is willing to do what President Obama doesn't do, which is bring up poverty. Obviously, what the caller just said, bring up the wealth gap, bring up the fact that the poverty rate has grown under this president. And Elizabeth Warren is willing to talk about that. And unfortunately, you know, we live in a country of 320 million people. We have close to 50 million people in poverty. So to have the president never bring those things up, or very rarely bring those things up, is problematic. So Elizabeth Warren, I think the reason that people respond to her in particular, she's willing to tick off the White House or do whatever it takes to say what should be talked about when it comes to issues that affect a disproportionate amount of people. And we talk about poverty, it's white and black. So, you know, you're right. I mean, the Democratic Party has a problem with attracting white males because they have spent, in my view, too much energy on niche political issues. I think you could do both at the same time, but for some reason, some of these political campaigns have not been particularly good at doing that.
Do you think that the issue still is, Lauren? I think it is, and I don't know why more politicians don't really reach out to the average person who's lost so much income in the last 20 years and is working so much harder and the wages are going down and people have to work a lot harder. I know that Clinton is on that message some. I know the Republicans are. I know certainly that Elizabeth Warren is, but some of them seem to be Johnny-come-latelys to the whole issue. Is that the issue in this campaign? Is that the issue right now in America?
Yeah, I think that any sort of bread and butter money-related issue is the issue. The other place I think that it's problematic for the Democratic Party is immigration, because nobody seems to want to have a very clear, forthright discussion about why it's a particularly good thing to have 5 million people who are not citizens in the country able to work. So nobody really has that discussion. There's a lot of discussion about us being the country who allows anyone in, et cetera, and so on. But the fact of the matter is, other countries don't do that. I can't go to Germany or England and just work, and that's it. You've got to get permission from that country to work in that country. And there's a reason for that, because, you know, the unemployment rate goes up when you have people who are outside the country trying to get jobs. So those types of discussions where we get into things that make people uncomfortable, and we understand the Democratic Party is trying to attract the Hispanic voter and that constituency. Everybody gets that. But at some point, you have to have that discussion. And it's a tough discussion. It's an uncomfortable discussion. But when voters don't see the party having that discussion, it's problematic.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call, Joel. Mike in St. Lawrence is next. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Kathleen. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I just going to give you a prediction here. I think Hillary Clinton, Mrs. Clinton, is a right-leaning Democrat, and I think that Jeb Bush is a left-leaning Republican, and I think the white male is going to trump the white female, and I think Jeb Bush will be our next president, and I don't think people like Cruz or Rubio or even Scott Walker from Wisconsin have a chance, because they're going to get bumped right out of there. I think basically their policies are going to be pretty much the same, and there's not going to be much discussion between either one of them. There won't be much of a debate. They'll nitpick on little bitty things. But anyway, I just thought I'd give you my prediction.
Thanks very much. We'll keep your thoughts in mind when we hear the results of the election. He might be right on, Lauren.
Yeah, absolutely, because generally what will probably happen here is that Hillary will have to run far to the right on foreign policy. And even on some social issues, she'll have to move a little bit to the right. Or I think she'll be advised to do that, and she's likely to take that advice. Those are the same thing her husband did in 1992. So, you know, when you're running center and then you're governing in a different position, yeah, that's kind of what President Obama did to some extent. He wasn't running completely center, but he certainly was talking about things like ending the Bush tax cuts, and then he gets into office and he doesn't end the Bush tax cuts. So you can run, you know, on economic issues like that, that the middle class voter will listen to, but you actually have to do it when you get to office. So the Democrats have, I think, a little bit of a problem where the Republicans don't have as much of saying things and not executing them when they get into office.
Our number is 800-486-8655. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. And our guest is Lauren Victoria Burke. She's covered politics on Capitol Hill since 1998. She does a great deal of writing now for Politic 365, which is a digital destination for politics and policy related to communities of color. She has covered the Hill for a number of places, USA Today, The Washington Post, The Hill, Associated Press. She's the author of Birth of a Statesman, which is a book of photography documenting President Obama's 2008 campaign for the White House. And she is the creator of crewof42.com, which is a blog on the Congressional Black Caucus. We go next to Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Well, you mentioned President Obama's speech. And you described it as eloquent. Well, it may have been eloquent, it was inspirational, but it doesn't really mean anything. And the reason it does not mean anything is because it does not address a central fact, that we as an American culture, and I'm talking now mainly about the white American culture, has not had any kind of reasonable discussion or rational debate about racism in the United States. It has not accepted responsibility for the deplorable conditions that exist among our minority populations. Anybody who has read Michelle Alexander or Douglas Blackman knows that. And until we do, until we're able to confront the fact that we have not paid the debts that we owe to our black citizens, nor, for that matter, to our American Indian citizens, are we able to really confront effectively the kinds of problems which involve economic justice that really face this country.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for your comments. Lauren?
Yeah, so I thought that the president's speech was, you know, good, the one in Selma. You know, I hear what Richard is saying. The conundrum that we have with regard to race is sort of twofold. One is that we live in a country with 300 years of history that we're all fairly aware of, but really not completely on the same page of. I mean, I think mostly black or white in America, when you think about race, you have to sort of learn about it yourself. You have to watch Eyes on the Prize or read a book or read a historiography, but it's not something that is taught uniformly in the school system. So everybody's on sort of a different page. The other problem is, if you're talking about any sort of economic answer to it, you're punishing the people who had nothing to do with it effectively. So we are where we at. Those people may have benefited from it, but they're not the people, you know, who actually did it. So there's also the problem of, if you have the reparations discussion, you know, when we say the nation should pay for that, well, the nation is taxpayers of the United States. Should they have to pay for something they didn't do? You know, it's one of the things that is kind of a problem when we talk about race in America. But, of course, Michelle Alexander's book outlined a lot of what's going on. I actually think a lot of that is fixable with regard to the criminal justice system. You are seeing a lot of Republicans now agree with a lot of Democrats with what people like John Conyers and Bobby Scott have been saying for years about the disparities in the criminal justice system with regard to race. Now we're seeing Rand Paul and Tea Party senators like Mike Lee agree with them. So, you know, the criminal justice piece can be fixed. The bigger piece in there is education. Obviously, education in America is really determined by real estate, unfortunately. And if you live in a rich area, you have a good education. If you don't, you don't. And disproportionately, that does break down the race. So when we talk about race in America, it's a very complicated discussion, as we all know. But it's something that certainly, because of the election of this president, he does have a point when he says, I do agree with this part of it. You know, his election is a huge moment. I mean, nobody right. could have imagined that. Mm-hmm. In my parents could not have imagined that. So that alone shows you that we have come a long way.
Yeah, and that image of John Lewis, bless his heart, and the President of the United States on the Edmund Pettus Bridge was just, I mean, that was, you do photography as well. That was a moment. That was a moment for the ages. It really was.
Absolutely.
I want to spend just a moment on this. The AP, I don't know if you've seen it, had an interesting story today, a fairly lengthy story on racist chants in recent years and racist actions at fraternities across the country, and saying that the spotlight's been on Sigma Alpha Epsilon at the University of Oklahoma. They're no longer in the picture. But they asked why this is occurring on such a widespread level. So that same fraternity was suspended at Clemson University, South Carolina. Phi Delta Theta halted its chapter at the University of Pennsylvania for issuing a holiday card with members posing with what it called a Beyoncé sex doll. Arizona State University banning Tau Kappa Epsilon last year after its Martin Luther King Day party had guests flashing gang signs and holding watermelon-shaped cups. And the list goes on and on. Even a sorority, Chi Omega, closing its Penn State chapter because of a photo with members wearing sombreros and fake mustaches and holding offensive signs, I will mow lawn for weed plus beer. Is this a pretty big problem? It's sort of hard for me to believe, Lauren, that we're getting this kind of action on any campus in the year 2015. What in the world's going on?
Well, there's a few things there. One is that, obviously, with the level of social media we have now, we're finding out more than we knew about each other than we were in previous generations. So, obviously, through Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, and so on, the ability to report, you know, the way people are behaving is a lot more prevalent, a lot easier to do that. Before, during the Civil Rights Movement, that came down to reporters, the New York Times and a few other papers who were covering the Civil Rights Movement. So I don't know that we could argue or that we know scientifically that there are more or less of these incidents. What I do think we do know, though, is that unlike what went on in the 40s and 50s and 60s in America, we have now situations where, David Boren, who was president of OSU is like somebody who is saying the types of things that would not have been said by a leader of college
mm-hmm.
in 1940 and 50.
Right.
So, I mean, if we consider that and the fact that it is probably likely, I don't know this for a fact, it's likely that a white kid was the one that revealed this tape of what happened on the bus with the fraternity. Now, those are the types of things that probably would not have happened in the 40s and 50s. You know, people generally kept quiet. So even though there's somebody that's doing something racist, there's also somebody there who is reporting it who's probably white as well. So you have to sort of look at both sides of it. We also have to remember we're a nation of 320 million people. And so even though these incidents are not good news, and I do think that they are to some degree a reflection of something, we shouldn't get too far carried away in thinking that it is the rule and not the exception.
Yeah. Let's go next. Thanks very much for the call, Richard. We go to Brett in Green Bay. Hi, Brett.
Hello. Thank you very much for your time. I'm calling about the fact that I'm 56 years old, and I've seen a lot around the United States, and I'm just wondering if we're heading for a new form of civil war. I mean, if any catalyst would happen, I think we're kind of on the verge. I've never seen any such deep-down racism in my life as I have in the last since Obama came in. Also, the fact that somebody like Elizabeth Warren, and we talk about police beat cops and places for sex trade or whatever, slave trade, to work on a civil defense program that would bring us back to our towns and rebuild the beat cop, rebuild the city from the ground up, and nobody's getting on that bandwagon. I don't understand.
Lauren?
Well, I think that if we were on the verge of a civil war, it would have happened already. I mean, you have to remember, we're a nation that has something like 310 million firearms in the hands of civilians. I mean, so if something was going to happen and jump off, it probably would have jumped off by now. I think, once again, that if you spend a lot of your time in your life watching Fox News and MSNBC, and that is the sort of limit of your world in terms of where you think the discussion is, you know, listening to people like Jason Riley or Al Sharpton, that is a very limited view. You know, I think most people in America spend their lives working and taking care of their family, not sitting around and arguing on TV about race riots and all that. That's all for entertainment in most cases when we watch cable news. So I do think, again, you have to keep these things in a little bit of perspective. There is certainly, you know, the Secret Service has said that there's an uptick of threats against this president. That should surprise absolutely no one, given 300 years of American history in this country with regard to African Americans. So that's part of our history. That's part of what made America. The situation around slavery and civil rights movement is part of our history. So we shouldn't be surprised when we see some of the things that happen are directed toward this particular president. But again, you know, if something bigger than that was going to happen, I think it would have happened already.
Michael on Facebook writes, we know that Clinton didn't use a government email account, but what about Kerry or Biden or Obama? Are any of them using the government accounts to conduct government business? What does that say about accountability and transparency?
Well, I know that Obama, there was a big discussion about his BlackBerry when he first got in, and they eventually took it away from him. I don't know that he emails anybody, and I'm not sure about Biden either or Kerry. But, you know, that's something that I'm sure they will get asked before this story ends.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. It's All Things Political you're listening to for this Monday, the 16th of March. Lauren Victoria Burke is our guest. She's a political analyst. She writes a great deal for a website that is, you know, fairly new, Politic365. She's the creator of crewof42.com, which is a blog on the black members of the House, and she has been on the Hill for a long time covering politics since 1998 for a number of publications. We have a line open if you'd like to join our conversation. We've been busy. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. You're always welcome to leave messages for us. We like to read them, and you like to read each other's opinions, right? The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All things political going on this hour. 800-486-8655 is the number. And Kurt in Chippewa Falls, our next caller. Lauren, hi, Kurt.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Couple things. The going back to the relative Republican wins, losses, Democrats, so forth, I believe there's been a sort of a tacit agreement between Republicans and Democrats ever since FDR, whereby business, big business, could do just about anything they could get away with in this country, and the Democrats, and they in turn would let Democrats create tax-paid social programs to make up, you know, to take care of the damage that was done. Okay, and ever since Reagan, that agreement has been broken by the Republicans. They are, you know, they are now indifferent to the damage that big business does. And they are not willing to let Democrats continue spending more and more money to make up for the damage. And so what we have here is that the big money behind Republicans, they are paying for to get their agenda enacted into public policy, whereas the big money behind the Democrats is there to keep the Democrats from damaging the big money interests.
Lauren?
Well, you know, I actually don't think that our political parties are organized enough to function any sort of agreement where that would be the case. But I will say, along the lines of what Kurt just said, is that, you know, clearly corporations have a power over our politicians because of money. Certainly after the Citizens United decision, it got a lot worse and continues to get worse. I'm having a difficult time figuring out why politicians don't fix that, both Democrat and Republican, because everything has become about raising money and not for the better. So in other words, it's about that, and it's not as if our system of governance is getting better because of it. And it's just a pain in the neck, you know, people are spending so much time just raising money on both sides. So it's unclear to me why they won't get together and simply outlaw certain things, but the way it stands now is that, you know, citizens have to be very savvy and very, very diligent about organizing and getting together and not just doing that, but in fact raising money.
Somebody did, and I can't remember the numbers, Lauren, maybe you do, of the amount of time per month that an incoming member of Congress used to spend asking for money, comparing it to now. And it's just the figure, I got to find that. It knocks your socks off because it's
right.
Just so much time. They must not like doing that, for heaven's sake. Who would want to do that?
I know. And every politician I talk to over the years, I've always heard this. They hate asking for money, that they hate having to raise money. And yet nobody makes a move to really change the system, and it's getting worse. So I'm not sure why that can't happen. I suspect the amount of time, if I had to put a number on it, I'll look for that story, but if I had to put a number on it, it'd probably be something on average. Got to be at least 10 to 15 hours a week,
right.
Which, you know, it's time taken away from constituents, et cetera, and so on. You know, most people do have their fundraisers at night when you would not be in the office anyway. So, or really early in the morning, you'll have fundraising, breakfasts, et cetera. But still, I mean, you're doing something that has nothing directly to do with constituent or representative government.
Right. Thanks very much for your call. Alice in Sheboygan, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Alice.
Hi. I was calling back in the 70s when I went back to school at Madison. The very first course I took to warm me up to getting back into school was with one of the early black professors in the new Afro-American Studies department named Finley Campbell. And it was Racism and the Black Experience, and we read the manifesto. But it opened my eyes up to what we're dealing with in life. It quite often has to do with it's a class, kind of class change. And I just think your guest is wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And I just had to say that I enjoyed that class, enjoyed all the classes, and she's right on. She's spot on.
Thanks very much for the call. Why don't you, Lauren, talk a little bit more about the crew of 42 that you set up, and also the writing that you're doing for Politic 365, which is really a good political website for everybody.
Yeah, Politic 365 was created by Crystal High, who's from North Carolina, about 4 or 5 years ago. And basically what we're doing is just covering politics from mostly a Black and Latino perspective, but not only a Black and Latino perspective, because the nation's demographics are changing. And the blog Crew of 42, I started in 2009 on African-American members of Congress because I felt like there were certain stories that weren't covered. There was certain work they were doing that you never would know anything about because nobody covered it. And really, the direction of the blog was just to cover their legislative work and not so much, you know, things that have nothing to do with anybody and don't really matter to anybody. I mean, you have two Black members of Congress, for example, who are on appropriations, who decide over billions of dollars. So just covering them, you could just do a blog just on covering those two members. But, you know, it's an interesting look into the constituencies that they cover, many of which are becoming more Hispanic, and many of which are, you know, they have a lot of, the Black Caucus has a lot of districts that are majority white or majority Latino. So it's kind of interesting because you end up covering everybody at some point in that. And so that's the blog.
Why did you publish the names of the Black Caucus who sat in for the Netanyahu speech?
Because everyone was trying to figure out at the time, like, who was going, who wasn't going, asking them beforehand. They weren't getting particularly clear answers. So I was sitting up in the press gallery, so I just counted everybody that was there and just published it. You know, when I think about it, I felt sort of silly after, because at the end of the day, there were people who didn't go, who didn't, you know, are not wildly against Netanyahu. They just had a conflict. They had a meeting. So the not going or going really didn't mean as much as people may have thought.
Mm-hmm. What about his winning or his losing? Will that mean a lot?
I think, good question. I don't know. You know, I really don't know. A lot of people are expecting him to lose.
Right.
I don't know. We have this special relationship with Israel. But I think whoever, if it's not him, it's not going to change that much with regard to policy. So,
and what do you make, Lauren, of Republicans starting to walk back their signing of the letter to Iran?
Well, they should be walking back their signing of the letter because, you know, number one, Tom Cotton has only been in the Senate for three months. And number two, Tom Cotton was barely in the House. He was only in the House for one term. Yeah, he served in Iraq and Afghanistan. My nephew served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Thousands of people in our country served their country in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I'm not sure why Tom Cotton thinks that he's the only one to have done that. But at any rate, you know, the fact that people did not vet this letter and really, the fact that we basically have 47 senators who are giving advice to the Iranian government, I think is very problematic.
One more phone call. I guess that person hung up. I'm interested in your thoughts from a national perspective, because the governor of our state certainly is getting to the head of the pack here for Republican frontrunners. What do you make of Scott Walker? What do you make of his chances for being a nominee?
I think he's the flavor of the month in the same way that, you know, people like Herman Cain and Ben Carson. I mean, we see this all the time. We have to remember that we almost have a full 2 years to go here.
Yeah, I know.
And this is not to say that Scott Walker won't do well. He'll probably do okay. But there are other candidates that are going to come up that will challenge him. I actually think Rand Paul is going to do fairly well. And I think that there are other people who are going to show up. So, you know, it's all very exciting right now. But there's a lot to go through before we get there. I do think the problems that obviously the huge clash that he had with labor is going to come up again. It's very hard to argue that you're for the middle class and do what Scott Walker did with regard to labor. So, you know, that's most of the people in America. So that's problematic. So we'll see. Right now he is sort of the flavor of the month on the Republican side. But 3-4 months from now, we may be talking about somebody else.
Yeah. Lauren, thank you. You obviously know your business, and I love your directness. Thanks so much for being with us. I enjoyed the hour.
Thank you. very much. Thanks for having me.
Lauren Victoria Burke, our guest this hour. You may want to go to the website, which is Politic 365, which is covering lots of important political issues. She's been covering politics for a number of years, started with Cokie Roberts at ABC News some years ago. And if you didn't get on the air and you want to leave comments, go to our Facebook page, because we like to have you have a chance to read them, and we like to read them as well. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to Lisa Nalbandian and Scotty Myers for on-air production in downtown Milwaukee.